As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
This is Good Together, the podcast that inspires you to create positive change in the world every day by being a conscious consumer. I'm your host, Laura Alexander Wittig, founder of Brightly.eco, and I started this podcast a few years ago because I wanted a place to talk about the gray areas around sustainability and how being a conscious consumer can be challenging and confusing, but it's totally doable. So join me in the name of reducing waste and living positively in the name of the planet. Together listeners, after almost 4 years of going strong, this podcast is on a well-deserved break. While we're gone, we're sharing some of the most impactful episodes we've run to date, focusing on real-world sustainable-ish problems you face every day. Keep listening for insights and more. Good Together listeners, I'm thrilled to bring Jessica Cross on to the podcast today because at the end of the day, I feel like we're all talking a lot about greenhouse gas emissions and what they're doing to our atmosphere, but we don't really focus that much about our oceans. And so that's a question best posed to Jessica Cross, a research oceanographer who's with the National Ocean and Atmospheric Administration, otherwise known as NOAA, based here in Seattle. And actually, Jessica's very close to me. I think I'm right next to their NOAA's headquarters over here, like the neighborhood over next to mine. So fun. Jessica has spent her career focusing on ocean acidification in the Arctic regions and the effect that those changing conditions are now having on natural cycles and biology. So welcome to the podcast, Jessica.
Thanks a lot, Laura. It's good to be with you today.
Yes. So I wonder if you can just introduce yourself and kind of let our audience know a little bit about what brought you to this particular area of study, around ocean acidification. So interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. When I was in college, I had the opportunity to do an undergraduate research fellowship. They offered those kinds of opportunities at Rhodes, which is where I went to school. And I got really into this idea that carbon dioxide is having an impact not just on our atmosphere, but also on all sorts of different reservoirs around the planet. The ocean is one of them. The land is one of them. And I decided that I wanted to use my computer to see if I could study how carbon dioxide molecules from the atmosphere actually interacted with water molecules at the surface of the ocean. I very quickly figured out that that was a terrible way to try and figure out how those chemical reactions occur because the ocean is obviously a lot bigger than single molecules.
Okay.
And I was lucky to be able to link up with some professors who were taking samples and doing modeling. And I entered graduate school at the University of Alaska Fairbanks to study ocean acidification.
That's fascinating. And I think that's just, you know, specifically, we'll kind of talk about what that process is and why this matters. But for me, what's interesting is, you know, you started so early on in your career and you thought, you know what, I am, you know, really, really interested in exploring this further. And then taking that a step, you know, even a step further than that and thinking about, well, how is this actually impacting all of these other systems that might seem unrelated. So I'm wondering, can you explain a little bit about what ocean acidification is to our audience and sort of, you know, what's going on with that process?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started thinking about, you know, molecule to molecule interactions. The lab that I worked in was a theoretical chemistry lab. Most of the other folks that I worked with in undergrad were studying how proteins and their substrates fit together. There's a lot of biomedical applications for stuff like that. And I was interested in more, you know, how these kinds of interactions happened in broader ecosystems. And as I got more and more into ocean acidification, I realized that while I might be studying a chemical reaction, this has real world consequences for all kinds of living things, especially in the oceans. So what happens is that, you know, on a molecular level, when we're talking, you know, molecules to molecules, carbon dioxide to seawater, what happens is that carbon dioxide, it initiates a cascade of chemical reactions in the surface ocean. This has all kinds of implications. It just really sets off this massive chain of dominoes, right? So in the end, the two key factors that we really care about when it comes to ocean acidification is that the end of this cascade of chemical reactions usually results in there being more hydrogen ions floating around in the ocean. That's where ocean acidification gets its name from. This is a lowering of pH or an acidification. But there's a second factor too. That cascade of chemical reactions that's caused by how carbon dioxide in the atmosphere interacts with seawater at the ocean surface also results in a reduction of carbonate ions. And a lot of organisms in the ocean use carbonate ions to regulate their biological functions, whether that is things like building shells and skeletons out of carbonate ions, or really just using those in a sensory capacity to sort of feel out their environment around them.
Okay. Wow. I mean, so that really kind of explains how the process is working and really like why it's important to track this. But I mean, I think, you know, at its very basic level, right? I mean, we're tracking that seawater is becoming more acidic, and you know, considering that most organisms in the ocean aren't used to that level of acidity, you know, that to me, that's kind of how I used to think about it, which sounds like it's like a really, really simplistic way of thinking about it, but perhaps not totally wrong.
Hey, it absolutely isn't totally wrong. It's a great thought. I mean, Think about the things that you're used to when you experience any kind of big change in your life. We just experienced one here in Seattle where we went from summer smoke to winter cold.
Oh my
almost
God.
Overnight.
So quick, right? Overnight.
Right? I don't know if your seasonal allergies went off like a bomb. Mine certainly did.
Yes.
It creates a little bit of stress in your life, right?
Yeah.
Maybe not fatal, but certainly annoying. This is something that you have to adjust for or make different choices for. And the ocean pH is doing the exact same things to organisms that are living in the ocean. It stresses them out a little bit. And there's all kinds of ways that stress can manifest, just like there's all kinds of ways that stress can manifest for you and me.
Well, I mean, that makes total sense. And you're right. Like we did have such a strange weather event here, and we have, I mean, for the past few years we've had so many unseasonable things going on in Seattle. And, you know, of course we're not the only ones affected by something like this. So I think it's really interesting to tie it back to these, you know, sort of real life examples that we can all think about. So as we've kind of understood a little bit more about like what the process is and sort of maybe how it could start to affect what's going on in the ocean, let's drill down into that a little bit more too. So what are some of these main effects that we're starting to see because of this change in acidity?
Right. So As oceanographers, as researchers, we tend to break ecosystems down into their functional parts. And all of those different parts of ecosystems tend to have sort of similar reactions to changes in their environment, which is why they get grouped that way. So I'll do the same thing here. Let's start at the top and think about things like fish, right, that are highly evolved. They're sort of the hoity-toity parts of the ecosystem, right? They have complex nervous systems and sensory challenges and sensory systems. And yeah. Ocean acidification creates sensory challenges for them. And so it's sort of, we're still trying to understand all of the different ways that changes in pH interfere with those sensory systems. But sometimes we think it interferes essentially with a fish's sense of smell. How does it react to the smell of a predator or the smell of blood in the water? How does a fish react to the scent of prey? Can it really distinguish those signals from each other in acidified conditions? We're not really sure yet. We just know that it's a little wonky, right? That fish aren't making good choices.
Yep.
The same way that when we're stressed, maybe we don't make the best choices, right?
Yeah.
But it's also about whether or not those fish have enough to eat. So ocean acidification impacts not just these higher level organisms like fish and whales that can really self-regulate in a lot of ways. It also impacts, you know, other kinds of organisms.
Yeah.
Taking a step down in the evolutionary scale, let's talk about shellfish. So organisms like oysters and corals and crabs, for example, that make hard shells and skeletons out of calcium carbonate, they need those carbonate ions that are just floating around in the water. And ocean acidification makes those less prevalent. And so that means there's fewer carbonate ions to go around.
They're just not able to maintain their shells? Does that mean they die? Or how does that affect them?
Right. It depends. The more evolved you are, the more capacity you have to maybe make some adjustments. Maybe let's say if you have a certain amount of food that you can eat that sort of helps you upregulate your energy, you can search for more carbonate ions or filter more of them out. You can keep, you know, use that extra metabolic capacity to keep your shell building up, but maybe you can't. Maybe that's not the way that your genetics play out, your genes play out. Maybe instead, as a shellfish, you just start to build your shell slower and slower or stay smaller and smaller. And you can imagine how that may have impacts on people that want to harvest big shellfish to eat. Example.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because I've noticed that. So my husband and I, so we're based very close to you here in Seattle, but we also spend time down, you know, by the water, like a lot of us
right.
do. And we've noticed in the region that we're more familiar with, kind of close to Tacoma, they have, you know, not allowed crabbing for a long time. And that had been, you know, something that was, you know, a general tradition in the region. And so the crabbing ban has, you know, lasted longer than we've been going down there, but people keep saying, oh, you know, the good old days, we're able to get all these crabs. And so I'm curious to know, like, yes, I mean, I would imagine that this ocean acidification, in addition to just impacting the wildlife and everything we're talking about, it's obviously going to impact, you know, industries that are built on, you know, fishing and, you know, shellfish harvesting, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Right now, one of the clearest examples we have of impacts of ocean acidification on an industry like that actually comes from Washington State.
Okay.
What happened was that some CO2-rich, carbonate-poor seawater, there was a big event wherein there was lots of this water that was pulled up onto the coast of Washington. And that's the exact same water that a lot of shellfish hatcheries were using to filter their tanks, right? To cycle their tanks. And unfortunately, what this meant was that all the oyster larvae, not as big, not as able to regulate their own homeostasis, really struggled and ended up dying in those environments. And there was this huge hatchery crash. cost lots of money. People weren't really sure where they were going to get their seed stock from to actually support, you know, some of these farmed shellfish. And that's really been kind of the classic example that we use of impacts of ocean acidification on fisheries. When it comes to things like crabbing bans and some of these organisms that are able to regulate their metabolism, are able to regulate their internal processes a little bit more, it takes more than one stressor to kind of kick them over the edge, right?
Okay.
If it was just ocean acidification, maybe they could handle that. If it was just increases in temperature, maybe they could handle that. But the reality is they're not experiencing any one of these stressors by themselves.
Yeah.
They get the whole portfolio at once. And as researchers, it can be really hard for us to tease apart what all of the individual impacts of each stressor is. So I don't know if the crabbing ban is an ocean acidification problem, but I can probably say it's not helping.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Exactly. No, that makes total sense. And you're right. There's so many different, things going into the equation when we think about impacts on specific populations. So that makes total sense to me. And yeah, speaking more about the shellfish industry, we have a statistic here that was saying that, if the ocean acidification problem continues to be left unchecked, it's estimated that the U.S. shellfish industry, it's like a tongue teaser, can lose more than $400 million annually by the year 2100. So, I mean, this is something that is going to continue to impact us, from that perspective alone. And one thing that I thought was interesting that you mentioned when you were talking about the impacts, about that one anecdote from the Washington State perspective is, look, I mean, that event cost the shellfish industry, lots of money. And so, from our perspective, when we think about conscious consumerism, we recognize that like the buying of new things is not going to get us out of climate change. But what it can do, what at least the money part can do is really galvanize big corporations to act. So I'm curious to know, as we start to see impact felt from a dollar perspective, like are big industries, maybe the shellfish industry, maybe there's a few others that you know of, like are they starting to pay attention because it's affecting their bottom line?
No question about it. I do most of my work in Alaska every year. And Alaska is one of the regions that has really taken an interest, sort of looked at the Washington State example and said, we don't want that to happen to us.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we monitor conditions to make sure that it doesn't? And I've been a part of trying to work with, local hatcheries, crab fishermen, fishermen's unions around the state to really educate them about what the risks are and how they can mitigate those risks, right? A lot of times that's about being conservative with fisheries management, right? Let's really work hard not to overfish or to engage in sustainable
yeah.
fishing practices. And Alaska is really good at that. That being said, all of these stressors together probably has led to a big crash in the crab fishery in Alaska across the last several years. Again, we're not really sure we can pinpoint exactly which part of the problem led to that fisheries crash, but we do know for sure that crab industry, that crab population in Alaska has been experiencing so many stressors over the last several years that they were really hovering on the edge to begin with. And that's a challenge, right? When you talk about fisheries management and you talk about mitigation, you know, that's really wonky. It's easy for me to talk about that with like industry insiders, yeah. right? But what can regular people do? What can regular, you know, everyday Americans do to really encourage those kinds of sustainable practices? And like you were saying, it's encouraging corporations towards some of these sustainable options.
Yeah. And that was actually going to be my next question. So we talked a little bit about like, yeah, what the future is going to look like if we don't, you know, start to see some changes happening. One thing that we didn't quite get into, but you alluded to it a little bit, which is like, you know, if we keep going down the path that we're going on, there are going to be winners and losers in the marine plant system, right? Like there yeah. are some plants such as, you know, seagrass that can potentially benefit from increased carbon, but they're also going to, you know, face challenges as well. So there's definitely going to be winners and losers here. And so as we think about solutions to, you know, helping the problem or helping like mitigate the problem of ocean acidification, there have been some, you know, some positive, I think, from native seaweeds. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the ways that we're thinking about mitigating ocean acidification risk now is through really trying to support carbon removals.
Okay.
And in some cases, that can be really easy, thinking about like restoring an ecosystem that may have been damaged. So restoring natural seagrass beds or natural kelp beds, it's a win-win for everybody, right?
Yeah.
The advantage is that marine plants, they use carbon dioxide, they breathe carbon dioxide just like we breathe oxygen. And so that's naturally pulling carbon dioxide out of the system. And that can help mitigate ocean acidification a little bit, we think. There are nuances.
Okay.
But also farming that kind of stuff, really trying to pull as much carbon dioxide out of the ocean as we can, might also help mitigate ocean acidification. And there's ongoing work studying that those options in California and then as well in Alaska. In Alaska, one example that I really like to point to is a group that is trying to come up with an indigenous kelp farmers' bill of rights that's trying
oh,
to
wow,
highlight
that's fascinating.
right? Trying to highlight the sustainable ways that kelp farming and macroalgal farming in our ocean coasts has been used, you know, since time immemorial. And how can we do that sustainably? How can we use those as restoration practices? How can they share that knowledge with the rest of us?
I mean, I think that's so interesting. And I, you know, like I was saying before, I think as we hear about big problems, like big, scary problems like this, it can be really easy for us to just kind of, you know, put our heads in the sand and think like, okay, I don't know anything about ocean acidification, even though I just listened to this podcast, like I still don't feel like I know enough and I don't really know what I can do to help. And so I agree that like, you know, number one, we can, you know, really put pressure on some of these bigger companies who have roles to play in these industries to do things in more sustainable fashions. We can also support startups and companies who are trying to, yeah, capture carbon out of the atmosphere. And I think there's so many cool ones that we hear about all the time. And, you know, so more power to them as they develop these really necessary, but, you know, technically challenging systems. And another thing that you, I think you had put in our show notes that I thought was really interesting is the need to invest in clean energy. So tell us a little bit more about how that maps back to the problem of ocean acidification.
Absolutely. The more carbon dioxide we put in the atmosphere, the more carbon dioxide the ocean soaks up, the more acidified the water gets.
Yeah.
Very simple. So one of the best things that we can do to slow ocean acidification is stop putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, that's about as simple as it gets, right?
Everything. One of the
I love it.
I like to give is that recently, like my mom has been hearing me talk about all of this kind of stuff. It's time for her to start replacing some of the tools that she keeps in her garage.
Okay.
A edger, a weed whacker, a mower, and that kind of stuff. And I have been really trying, like, mom, you got to get rid of the gas powered stuff. And she is. She's starting to buy battery powered tools for her garage.
Yeah.
And that's what it takes. Simple as that.
Absolutely. No. And the other thing that's really interesting about that too, is there is such a, you know, there's like a lot of people, especially older folks or just people who have been, you know, consumers in the space for a long time. There are definitely misplaced notions around the effectiveness of, you know, electric tools or just things that are more eco-friendly, right? So I am sure there's a bunch of people who think, well, I'm really used to using a gas-powered leaf blower, and it, you know, it has a lot of power behind it. So if I go use an electric one, I'm worried it's not going to work as well. I mean, maybe that was the case a long time ago before we had the technology that we do now, but we definitely have options that work well. We have an electric leaf blower here, and not only is it effective, but I'm always just amazed at how quiet it is compared to like the old-fashioned ones, right? And so it's like, that's just a really nice side effect, but it works fine, you know? So I'm sure there's always going to be a little bit of like education that goes with that, right?
Well, and you have to develop the solutions that work best for you. I can imagine a landscaping company is going to need something with a little bit more industrial power.
Yeah.
But for me, just taking care of my garden, I can make different choices.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. And there's never a one-size-fits-all solution to a product recommendation, right? Like what's good for one person is not necessarily going to be good for everybody else. So yes, I love the thought process of just electrifying everything, because I think that it's just, we just really have to get to that perspective. You also mentioned the general need to obviously conserve and restore our coastal and marine ecosystems. So what can the average consumer do to help with that, that cause?
Right. One of the biggest things in sort of the coastal conservation movement right now is trying to reduce plastic waste.
Yes.
Supporting efforts to clean up plastic, supporting efforts to study microplastics, which is what happens when plastic erodes or dissolves in the ocean. Those are really important facets for conservation as well. So get that reusable water bottle, keep it as long as you can.
Yep. And you know what? People like kind of get on our case sometimes, like, oh my gosh, can you guys please stop talking about plastic waste? But it's something that we're really passionate about here, because I think there are just so many items that we all grew up with using all the time that we just don't even think twice about. Like plastic wrap, I think, is a huge one that just, you know, just infiltrated our daily lives, like Ziploc bags, all these things. And there are reusable alternatives to these things that work just as well. There's also people that are coming up with like compostable, plastic wrap type things made out of other things. So there's all sorts of different, you know, options for consumers out there. And from my perspective, it just starts by just simply thinking about things. And speaking of thinking about things, I mean, for me, I'm constantly, constantly like thinking about microplastics and not trying to freak out too much, but microplastics are a big problem. Jessica's totally right. We need to make sure that we are funding additional research into the space, because we cannot even, I just think we have just scratched the surface of what's going on with that. I'm sure Noah is keeping a close eye on this as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like you were saying, one of the best things that we can do about climate change, about all of these kinds of impacts on our coast for conservation, the best thing that we can do is talk about it. We'll learn from each other. We'll learn what we don't know. We don't know a lot about microplastics yet, but you're talking about it, which I think is great. We're talking about ocean acidification, right? The more we talk about these issues, the more that we can find solutions together and come up with pathways for adaptation and mitigation.
I couldn't summarize it better myself. I mean, you're right. None of us are going to be total experts in this space, right? Even people that dedicate their lives to these certain topics, no one's going to know every single thing about it. But it is good for us to familiarize ourselves with some of these topics, be ready to, you know, think more critically about them when we hear them being brought up. I mean, I always love that I have general knowledge about a pretty wide breadth of topics in the environmental space, so that, for instance, like we just came off of an election yesterday, right? When you start to hear politicians like throw words around, whether they're trying to use them for good or bad, to scare people or to galvanize people, right? Like, at least you might think to yourself, well, like, is that actually what they're saying? Or, you know, being a little bit more critical and also being more willing to, you know, maybe vote for a policy that might actually impact the environment. And you actually can read through, you know, when you go to the ballot, you read those what do you call it, you know, descriptions of different things that you can pass. You know, it's always a really good way to just, you know, educate oneself. So totally agree, right?
Absolutely. And I mean, the more that we talk about these things, the more that we hear about, you know, greenwashing and what actually counts as, you know, something that's helpful, an action that's helpful, an action that might not necessarily be so helpful, but kind of looks good on paper, right? How do you tell the differences between these different options that are out there, right? You know, my gas company offers me the opportunity to offset any emissions that come from using the natural gas that powers my stove and my heat in the house that I live in, right? And, you know, I'm an expert, so I can certainly evaluate whether or not that's a good idea for myself. And I know where to find that information, but also just making sure that that information is available to everyone. How is that offset generated? Is it a high quality offset or a low quality offset? So those kinds of options, really evaluating offset quality, that's also not something that we're very good at broadly yet. And so supporting efforts that really try and develop high quality offsets, high quality actions that can really impact the environment and do some good, that's always great. And we can't do any of that if we're not talking about the issues, which is why I'm so glad to have been able to be here with you.
Awesome. Well, this was a great conversation, and I totally agree. Using the term carbon offset as a blanket sort of get out of jail free card, like that, it drives me nuts, right? Or companies that are just like doing things that are very bad for the environment, and then they're like, oh, well, we're just going to write off, you know, a big chunk of our, well, not usually a big chunk, a very small chunk of our profits into quote unquote carbon offsets. It's like, no, that's not the answer. Let's try and solve the problem at its root, right? That doesn't mean to say that there's not good, high quality carbon offsets, like Jessica just mentioned. So, you know, actually, I don't think if we've done an episode specifically on that, but that's a good reminder for me to put that one on the calendar for us to kind of go into the different variations there. But yeah, Jessica, I had such a nice time chatting with you. Maybe I'll come over and say hi at the office. Like, I literally could walk to it.
Oh my goodness. It would be so good to see you.
Yes. Maybe I'll pop over there and say hi one day. Yeah, I live very close to Matthews Beach. So just right down the street.
Fantastic. I do a lot of stargazing at Matthews Beach.
Oh, wonderful.
It's dark this time of year, and we'd be happy to give you a tour of the lab.
Oh yeah, I would love it. I'd love it. So yes, wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Jessica. And what we'll do, listeners, there were a lot of really interesting statistics and resources that we talked about in today's episode. So don't forget to check out the show notes. And as always, I'm very interested in what's going on with NOAA and our other governmental agencies dedicated to, you know, protecting the environment. So thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for joining us on another episode of Good Together. To get show notes and more, head to brightly.eco/podcast. Finally, don't forget to join in on the conversation with us on social media. You'll find us on almost everything at brightly.eco. Don't forget, we're all on this journey together, so have fun putting the planet first and stay curious.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.